That's a really special pop.
Today is the it's day 5 of the Shodashi shift 2018.
And we have something beautiful to talk about. As usual.
I've just heard this 10 minutes ago, so I'm a bit stunned and I don't know how much help I'm going to be.
So I try to go over it again. And I'll make it. I'm stunned too. I mean, you can tell.
Yeah.
From looking at me that I'm totally floored.
Well, I was working in your office at a desk, and you lay down on the day bed and started reading something that you'd written that you'd printed out, and then you kind of went under the covers and just there was lots of moaning and groaning.
And fucking A.
And I've learnt to ignore you. And not, you know, not say, are you all right? Are you? I think I did ask you if you were all right once. But anyway, you were saying that you were having a meltdown. And then you changed that and you said, no, actually, it's a melt-up. So the reason that we popped a cork and the reason that we're celebrating is because you've got the final piece to your life's work. All the pieces are in place now.
Yes.
So it's a momentous day. I'm going to cry.
Truly is. And so the toast will be to that final piece, the culmination of the whole Sophianic vision, and it's called Identification of the Writer. So while I was having this melt-up, which goes back to the 25th of August when I wrote these 8 pages, called The Identification of the Writer, you were sitting at the desk working on Nemata.
HTML.
Doing HTML and dragging yourself through all of that stuff. And because you just wound up the momentous job of putting all of the G&E on Nemata, I asked you a question about some talks.
The initial conditions, yeah. Right. Which were audio files in the G&E.
Yeah, it so happened that in February of 2012, the G&E had been running for about 9 months. I did these 2 talks, I think in part 1 and part 2. Called Initial Conditions of the Divine Experiment. And actually, to fill in the plot here, I might add this factor. Some time ago, a few months back, I think it was, after the Charlotte working, maybe, so it was like in the spring, I felt this tug that I sometimes feel, this intuitive nudge, I would call it. And somehow I had an intuitive nudge. Let's go back and look at these 2 talks. Listen to these 2 talks. The Initial Conditions of the Divine Experiment. You see, how many talks are there in the G&A? 140?
You always blow my mind, John, because, you know, you don't know where your socks are or your shoes or your, you know, whatever, anything in the toenail. You never know where anything is and you lose everything. But your mind, in terms of your work, you know, you'll say to me randomly, oh, did I talk about such and such in that talk? And how many talks have you done? Hundreds.
Hundreds, yeah. So out of these hundreds of talks, I got a nudge of my attention that said, oh, go back and really go back and look at Initial Conditions of the Divine Experiment. So I remember, probably back in spring, it was after the Charlotte working, I know. Why was my attention drawn back to those talks?
But this is the thing we were talking about just before we started recording, is that you often remark that it's not you, it's you doing it. It's you making the recording, it's you putting out the material, but I'm not saying you're channeling or anything like that, but there's something else, isn't there? And that's the only reason why you can keep track of what you said in what talk is because...
It's not channeling. And right. I said that when I set down the standards of the terma, and I will always say that. It's
not because you don't sit here and then you go into trance and your eyes roll in the back of your head.
No.
When you speak in a foreign tongue.
No, it's not channeling. It's 100,000 times better than any channeling that ever happened. It is the tensegrity of the weave of her imagination. Everything is material. The power of her imagination can be compared to a massive mycelium weave. But it's a mycelium weave that has tensegrity, like the sinews of the body, like the
fascia.
Like the fascia of the human body. It's muscular. It's supple. It has tensegrity. And when you live in the power of her dreaming, you feel the tensegrity and the vibration through the weave. And that's what happens to me all the time.
All the time.
I'm not remember. It's like I don't personally remember it. It just comes back to me at appropriate moments through the vibration or tremor
of the web.
So that's what happened with these two talks. I went back and listened to them. That makes a very loud pop on the recording.
Yeah, we're smoking tobacco.
Yes.
I'm drinking kava.
Pretending to smoke and drinking kava.
I'm really smoking.
And I have to say that when I went back and I listened to them, and I took some notes and I thought, oh, that's interesting. Did I really say that? You know, the usual. But I swear to you, I'm not making this up. I was so shocked by what I said. And I was just shocked. And I couldn't form an idea of why I would feel so shocked about what I said in those two talks. Now, today, at this moment, this afternoon, I know why I felt shocked. Because I'm in that shock again. But this time I'm surfing that shock. I'm in the curl, which is always calm. And I know, you know, in the way that only a Gnostic can know, I know what's impacting me and why it's impacting me. And that's when I went and I reread this paper called Identification of the Rider. So we've been talking about that for the last 40 minutes or so.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we just review this quickly? Well, I'll just say what I said to you a while ago. It's like, look, I'm a comparative mythologist. And so this is what I do. I compare myths. This is okay. So using my training and my self-educated discipline, so I recovered and reconstructed the Sophianic narrative. Okay, that's just a fact. You know, it's all factual. There's no speculation, no claims there. And then I made a point from the beginning to say to those who take an interest in this, if I ever embellish, if I ever extrapolate, or if I ever say anything or add anything to the narrative that cannot be taken out of the received materials of the Coptic and Greek literature and the polemics against the Gnostics, I will tell you so. I won't invent, I won't elaborate unless I'm completely transparent about it, right? And I'll tell you so. So that's what I did in these talks. Because I did a graft.
A myth graft.
I did a myth graft. I took the myth of the 10 avatars of Vishnu, and I grafted it onto the Sophianic narrative. That's what I did. That's what I thought I was doing. But actually, it turns out that something else was happening. So, let's consider that a moment. What did I say? Well, I made up something. I said, look, let's suppose that these 10 intervention scenarios were really kind of fantasies that unfolded in the mind of the Ansifier herself while she was in the Pleroma before she plunged and turned into the earth. Well, why would she have these fantasies? Well, the Anthropos genome was her brainchild, right? And her pet project, along with Thelite. And then she and the other aeons in the Pleroma had the opportunity to observe 9 world systems where the Anthropos genome
failed.
It seeded, and then something catastrophically happened, which from the Pleromic point of view, they would have to say, well, that experiment was a fail. Maybe they don't think in terms of fail, but that experiment, let's say, it blew up. It just ended catastrophically, right? And A1, A2, A3, A1 through 9, 9 strains of the anthropic genome seeded in planetary laboratories.
Imploded. And imploded.
Yeah. Right. And so they're all looking at that and, you know, wondering what happened. But she takes a special interest because she, being the designer of the genome, has a real empathic involvement with it. You know, she has something at stake, right? Mm. So also she's very young. It's probably even more shocking to her to see that these experiments can fail. But we have to put that word fail in quotes, but you know, they break down. It broke down into a catastrophic or what we would call a dystrophic escalation. Like some people say is happening on Earth today, that everything is going to shit, to hell in a handbasket, and the world has gone insane. That would be a failure of the divine experiment, right? So she witnessed those 9 instances over untold eons of time, right? And as she did so, this is what I said, I made this up. I said, well, as she witnessed them, she also visualized in her mind, hypothetically, how she could have intervened in each one of them in order to rescue the experiment. So what I said was that when I grafted this myth, Hindu myth, onto the narrative, I said, the Hindu myth is actually just a human recovery by some transcendental function in the human imagination, a human recovery of what she visualized in the Pleroma. These 9 world experiments did actually happen and they did actually collapse, but she did not actually intervene. She only visualized how she might have intervened. So I made that all really clear, didn't I?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So then it comes to the 10th avatar of Vishnu. And the 10th avatar of Vishnu is an intervention scenario that she visualized in the Pleroma. And it applies to a laboratory experiment in progress. The other 9 did not. The other 9 applied to laboratory experiments that aeons observed because 26,000 years is a day to them. So they could spend 2 months and they could observe hundreds of such experiments, right? So, but those experiments had transpired. The difference with the 10th episode of the 10 avatars is that it refers to an experiment that's still in progress. That's assuming, but no, it's not an experiment that's in progress yet, because the experiment with Anthropos 10 does not go into manifestation until she plunges and turns into the earth. So it's in one to come. So that's the difference.
So it's already in her psyche.
Right. It's already developing in her psyche. The other 9 have been done. So she's looking at the other nine and she's saying, oh, I would have done this in number two, in case number three, I would have done this. With anthropos number four, I would have done this. Now, anthropos number 10 is the next one that's going to happen. And she was probably not anticipating that it would happen in the way that it has happened, right? So she's saying, oh, well, I would like to make an avataric intervention if this happens in anthropos number 10. If this happens one more time, I will really make an avataric intervention, right? So that's the difference. 10 is in the future in her mind, and all the other nine have transpired. So, well, then we know what happened, according to the myth. It turns out that she becomes the setting for the experiment for anthropos 10. She herself becomes the laboratory setting. She herself is in material immanence in the planet, although the properties of the organic light are not diminished thereby. Her primary substance luminosity remains what it is and becomes available to certain human witnesses. So these are all the conditions of our experiment now that we know about. So then comes the moment when she is in the experiment with anthropos 10, when it is time to realize or implement the visualization that she had about it, mm-hmm. right? And that's Sophia's correction. So there is a visualization of how her correction will occur, and that visualization is just a picture of a white horse with no rider. That's the 10th avatar of Vishnu. The Kalki avatar is pictured as a white horse with no rider, right? Well, this is really fun to consider because we were talking about it earlier and the question comes up, well, like, who pictured that? Who pictured the white horse with no rider? Well, if the story that I'm telling is consistent and logical and gnostically coherent, then the answer is she did. So whatever the human agency was among the Vedic seers, the rishis, who brought this story in to imagination and wrote it down, they were actually just like scribes who were dictating in the Puranas what she had visualized.
Explain what the Puranas are.
The Puranas are a massive set of books running to tens of thousands of pages, I believe, which are said to be elaborate commentaries written over a long period of time. Elaborate commentaries on the Vedas.
So you make the analogy of the translations of the Andromeda.
The notes. In the translations from the Andromeda, you have the poetry, and then you have the commentaries. And the poetry is like the Vedas, which is a crystalline structure of philosophical teachings. But the commentaries are like the Puranas. They're narratives. So the Puranas are just full of narratives, of stories of supernatural battles. This is where the stories of the Vimanas come from, that there were spacecraft and nuclear war on the Earth in previous kalpas. And it's true, it's possible that the Puranas are records of things that happened for anthropos 10 in previous kalpas.
But the Puranas and the Vedas were recorded by an Aryan race.
They are the products of the genius and the visionary power of a certain Aryan race that it lived at that time. And they are the product and legacy of that Aryan race left to us. And there are many, many, many volumes of them. And among the many stories, I believe, perhaps I'm wrong, but I believe there's one called the Vishnu Purana, And I believe that the theme of the 10 avatars of Vishnu is found in this Puranic material. Okay? So, in any case, there it is. Let's consider it a transcription out of the memory banks of the goddess herself of that which she visualized in a pleromic state before she turned into the earth. I mean, that's pretty momentous. But I would stand by that. I would say that's what it is. Could those rishis do that? You're damn right they could do that. I wanted to tell this story during the GNE about the 36 tapas. It's a story about two yogis on a movie screen. So there's a movie and there's the silver screen, right? And there you're in a old movie house and there's a projector booth in back with a window, and the beam of the projector is coming from the projector to the screen, and there's a movie. And it's a movie about two yogis. And in the course of this movie, the two yogis realize that their projection's on a movie screen. That's what yogis
sounds
can
familiar.
Do.
Sounds familiar. I think you may have done.
I think I might have mentioned it. Yeah. But it gets better, because not only are they able, because of their extraordinary powers of concentration, to explore how consciousness works, not only are they able to realize that there are projections on a movie screen, but they decide to go into the beam. Follow the beam back into the projection booth and go into the mechanisms of the film and the camera. And that's what's called the system of the 36 tapas. It actually explains the detail of the projection of the cosmic dream as if it were a manual of a film projector.
I'm sat here with my jaw hanging open.
So, Anthropos 10 are us, sort of. We start out being Anthropos 10. We're in the Kalpa, which is one of many Kalpas. We don't know how many other days this experiment's been running. We're only talking about this day because that's all we can handle. This day is 25,920 years long, and we're about 200 years from the end of it, which is 10 minutes from the end of a day. And then we begin to realize certain things in the last 10 minutes of the day. One of them is, well, we have all this Gnostic and Sophianic intel now, which really tells us in the cosmic perspective where we are and what's happening. And contained in that narrative is the event of correction. So we're in correction. But what is correction to her? Correction to her is a white horse with no rider. So, as I said, as I was laying her on the bed,
huffing and puffing,
and groaning and saying, fucking A, you know, I've come to realize today that the visualization of the Kalki avatar as a white horse without a rider is not simply how she visualized how she would intervene if Anthropos 10 went off the rails, which it has done, but it's also a riddle she planted in the mind of Anthropos 10. So when I did this grafting thing, I just thought I was doing a routine job that a good, reliable, trustworthy comparative mythologist would do. But no, can you see now that something else much greater was happening? My doing that was just the occasion for the riddle to be disclosed. So what you're getting now, and what I'm getting as we're having this conversation, is that the disclosure of that riddle is the completion of my whole work. So I have reached completion, which most of my life, I never thought there would be completion.
Yeah, there's always, you know, 18 plates spinning. I've got that to do. Oh, shit, there's that. That's huge. I don't want to do that.
We just got another terma a while back about what the real nature of the moon is.
You got the terma.
Well, we got it together. So I'm stunned because this is the end. It actually has an end. My work actually has an end. It's just incredible to me. So there's a riddle. The Ansophia herself pictured for herself, she visualized for herself that she would intervene for Anthropos 10 if it went too insane. And
we're here.
We're here. It's the reality of the world. Now, I've proven by the Mandela effect that she has cracked into the first attention. She even cracked into the archonic medium of the internet. I have proven during the GNE, we tracked the reset for correction. And with the Mandela effect decoded exercise, I proved that correction is underway. And that proof is ongoing every day. We're just getting proof now from the Chemnitz. Chemnitz is proof. When you decode Chemnitz, you have flagrant proof that her correction is reaching into the heart of the evil and contamination, which is in Germany, of the dream. The Germans were the great dreamers. They almost pulled it off. It's not over yet, right? So, what are we talking about? We're talking about the riddle of the Kalki Avatar, okay? Why does the white horse have no rider?
But you said it's a two-part riddle.
It's a two-part riddle. That's right.
When he said that to me, I went, oh, no, I hate riddles. No. And then he started saying, but this is, if people can get this riddle, then that is their part in correction. That's the human role in correction, is to solve this riddle.
That's right. And not, it gets even better than that. I also said that the solution of this riddle is the guarantee that her correction will succeed. So everyone who shares in the solution of this riddle is part of correction at the point where you would know, if you share in the solution of this riddle, that her correction is absolutely cannot fail and shall not fail. And you can know this with every fiber of your being. You can know this and you can live it and enjoy it and be absolutely thrilled by knowing this. I mean,
yeah, you go from black pill to thrill pill.
Let's talk about the black-pilled aspect for a minute, because the subject of tragedy came up as we were talking about this, right? It's really important for anyone who uses this word tragedy, which actually comes from the Greek word meaning goat song. Odos, the odos means a song or chant, and tragos means goat. Right. So tragedy originally meant a goat song, right? But what is a tragedy? A tragedy is not a misfortune. What's the difference? Many misfortunes in life, right? Name
life
one.
Life does have misfortunes.
Yes. Yeah.
But a tragedy is something that affects the whole or a great number of people.
Due to the fact that a tragedy involves the destruction of something excellent and superior. So back in Greek times, no sane Greek, whether they were intellectuals of Athens or ordinary people, would ever have considered it a tragedy if a donkey kicked a donkey owner in the head and he died. You know, the olive seller died, right?
That's a victory.
Victory for the donkeys, right? Or tragedy that a child got crushed under a wagon. You know, they would have never called that a tragedy. They would have lamented it and they would have felt human grief and they would have said it's a great misfortune. But a tragedy only happens when something excellent and superior falls or is defeated, or so apparently defeated.
Yet another word that is misused.
Terribly misused.
Like many others.
Terribly misused in the media. Mm. You know, terribly trivialized.
Mm.
So we were reflecting on this situation, which is a deeply emotional, dramatic situation of our time. Those who get wise to the JQ consider themselves fortunate, I think, because they are on to the game.
Oh, it's a poison chalice, though, isn't it?
The poison, if you want to call it that, that comes with it, yeah, it can infect your mind. It can become an obsession. That's true. It's a challenge to stay sober with it, right? But it cannot be denied that the certain members of the Jewish people are operating at the executive levels of social evil on this planet, and that the depth and scope of their evil is inconceivably vast. This is a fact. So those who wake up to the JQ also tend to be devastated by what happened with the Third Reich, Hitler, and the German people. That was a tragedy. That was the fall or defeat in an extremely dishonest, vicious, and deceitful manner of something noble and grand and exceptional. And that weight of that tragedy is really, really strong. And that's what causes some people to be black-pilled.
Yes, that, and then looking at the social theatre, the Zenosh have it tied up pretty much. You know, they've got the American industrial complex behind them, the IDF, the, you know, there's only a few countries in the world that aren't run by them. Syria, North Korea.
Their program of cultural subversion by the cultural Marxist program has been, you know, successful for them up until now. It's starting to crack, but it's been really successful. You've got to hand it to them.
Yep, evil genius.
And so there's a tendency of those of us who wake up to the JQ to, you know, carry the burden of this tragedy emotionally and spiritually. And also, there is a nonstop chorus, 724, that's broadcast to the Goyim all around the world, and especially to the white races. It's like, fail, fail, fail. Hitler, fail. Third Reich, fail. You know, German people, fail, right? And that's a lie. They didn't fail. They did not fail. They could not fail. The solution to the identification of the writer has two parts, the historical part and the supra-historical part, which is the racial part. So the Sophia's correction is truly the solution to the insanity of the human race. It is the medicine to cure it, and it's a fast and powerful medicine. When it comes into effect, it comes into effect like a homeopathic dose. Anyone who's ever taken a real homeopathic dose that was correctly prescribed knows that you are in shock, because the effect of it is very rapid, isn't it?
Mm.
Right. This is how correction is. And part of the effect of correction in the historical aspect is the realization that grows in people. Been growing in us over the last few months now. Hey, wait a minute. They didn't fail. It's just not over yet. They didn't fail. He didn't fail.
They were stopped.
They were stopped.
Fail. It's different.
And they achieved their objective of saving Europe from a military takeover and turning it into a Soviet gulag nightmare, which is what the Jewish Bolsheviks wanted to do. So they lost the war, you could say, tragically. But they did not fail in the objective of the war.
Is this an appropriate time to bring up your new Russian?
Well, that comes in the second part of the riddle.
Okay.
So the first part of the riddle is, identification of the rider who would ride the white horse of the Kalki avatar. Well, what does Savitri Devi say?
It was Hitler.
Yeah. Savitri Devi, whom we admire, and whom certain of our close friends admire also very well, very dearly, was a devotee of the Reich, and she said, and she was part Indian?
Or she was Indian.
Yeah, she was Indian. So she spent a lot of time in India, and she was deeply connected with the Aryan race genius. And she said, point blank, that Adolf Hitler was the historical, physical embodiment of the Kalki avatar. And that is absolutely true. But it's only half of the riddle. So the identification of the rider, first part, the rider is Adolf Hitler, not was, is. Adolf Hitler himself said, and I remember seeing this quote somewhere, you know how they show this picture of someone with a quote beside them? He said, it won't fail. It will not fail no matter what happens. The mission of the German people and the Third Reich will not fail. So he knew. So that's half the solution to the riddle. Now, the other part of the solution is what comes when Nebita is up and running. So I'm not going to disclose it now. Do my usual teaser act. Okay. But I will say that it fell in my lap last week. After I wrote this piece. I wrote this piece on the 25th or 28th of August during the full moon. And I called it the identification of the rider. And that's when I realized that my grafting of the Vishnu myth onto the Sophianic narrative was actually her action going back to the Pleroma when she visualized her correction. And that she carried
her correction of the previous experiments.
Right. Mm. And when she visualized the correction that she would undertake in the experiment to come, even though she didn't know she would be in that experiment the way she is now, she held in the power of her imagination this riddling image of the white horse without the rider. And so that image now comes into human imagination. And by solving the riddle of that image, every single person who shares in the solution of the riddle of that image is guaranteed in the correction, is guaranteed to be an agent of the correction and gets the confidence that the correction will succeed, that it cannot fail. The correction cannot fail. The second part of the riddle I didn't have when I wrote this piece. But in the, what has it been, 2 weeks now since I wrote this piece, 2.5 weeks, something dropped in my lap.
Mm-hmm. And something it came. Quite extraordinary.
And it came in the most extraordinary manner. And I told you about it. I said, I have really, you know, I have a great, well, I don't know if I use the word treasure, but I have a gift to you. You know, to share with you, which was all the more stunning for me because of where it came from.
Mother Russia.
From Mother Russia. And I thought I knew Mother Russia pretty well. I thought I had covered the story like a good reporter. I had covered a lot of aspects of the great story of what happened in Mother Russia from the end of the 19th century into the 20th century.
So the suppression of the Sophianic revival.
That's right. There are probably two overpowering motives of the Zenosh for taking down Russia. One was, of course, greed and wealth.
And the fact that they're white.
Right, and that they're a white race, which tends to produce extraordinary geniuses, like literary geniuses, many. So they were greedy for the wealth of Russia, and they absolutely pillaged Russia, and they got, you know, filthy rich out of destroying the aristocracy, destroying the Russian royal family, and so on. But the second motive, I think, was equally powerful to them. They were facing a threat since around 1850, the Zenosh had been emancipated into the affairs of the European and American peoples, and they had done their worst very rapidly, very efficiently. But something arose in Russia that was a great threat to them, and that was the recognition of the Sofianic presence. So you have the Sofianic mysticism of Soloviev and even Berdyaev, Bailey, Bloch. You have this whole group of Russian intellectuals and visionaries. And I've covered that in a number of places, right? Number of interviews.
Yeah.
But there was one thing that I missed, and it dropped into my lap last week.
It drop into your lap?
Well, I was looking at this two-volume set over here.
That's right, yeah.
The Encyclopedia of Religion and Nature, edited by Bron Taylor, whom I crossed a few emails with in the last few days. So this Encyclopedia of Religion and Nature is quite an impressive resource book.
Two fat volumes, isn't it?
Two very fat volumes. And as I was reading through it, I read into the entry on, I can't remember the exact name of the entry, but it was about mysticism and esotericism in Russia at the turn of the century, which is a subject that I've delved into very deeply. And so it touched on the subject of the Sofianic mystique, as I call it. And by the way, I want to add that this Sofianic mystique that emerged in Russia before the First World War was coupled with Gaia theory. Gaia theory actually was first conceived in Russia by Vladimir Vernadsky.
So VV.
VV. I don't know who's laying in these clues, but they get pretty, it gets pretty flagrant around here. So, among those visionaries, there were scientific visionaries and poetic visionaries and literary geniuses and mystics and philosophers like Soloviev. Among that whole gang, there was a couple.
A married...
married couple.
Couple who
two
were poets.
Yeah. One of them was probably, certainly, in the top five of the most famous Russian women poets.
So you knew about them then?
Yeah.
Right.
Anna Akhmatova. Big name. But I knew less. I knew about her husband, but I knew less about him. His name was, I think, Nikolai Gumilev. And they were both symbolist poets of the period of the Russian modernism. You know, and they were on the level. This is world-class people. This is world-class stuff. You know, they go up there with anybody that you can name, right? Since they're less known because they're Russian, right? Well, they had a son. And you're going to fall out of your chair because I haven't told you this.
Oh,
you
no,
ready?
No, hang on.
Brace yourself.
Okay.
They had a son. His name is Lev Gumilov, G-U-M-I-L-O-V. And when their son was born, and when he was a young boy, before the father was taken off by the Jewish Bolsheviks and
murdered,
executed, father was executed, the boy himself eventually spent many years in the gulag, because of his anti-Semitic views. It's a big race romantic story. It's a big, what you call it, soin d'oeuvre romance, right? When the boy was quite young, a friend of the family, of their circle of poet intellectuals, you're going to know who this is, came to the family. I know.
Oh,
it's outrageous.
No, shut up.
No. I just learned this yesterday. She came to the family because they all knew each other. They're a group of about 200 people, probably less, about 150. Marina Svetayeva came to the family to meet this young boy. And she looked at him and she said, "My beautiful young child, you have a terrible fate. You will stand on a red line and green eyes will devour you." This is what she said to him. And that was a prophecy of what happened to him. He stood on a red line. What does that mean? Well, he just barely fucking survived the Jewish Bolshevik Stalinist regime. He was in and out of prison. He was in and out of surveillance.
But he was now to know anti-Semitic, wasn't he? So it's amazing he didn't get executed.
That's right. And he was an investigator of and an ideologue of racial theories. He was a racial realist. And he produced some of the most profoundly researched and lucidly developed racial theories of the whole 20th century. And he brought a word into the language of racial theory, which is the word that is part of the second part of the solution of the riddle.
The riddle.
So, this young man, the second thing was, by green eyes, she meant envy. And who is the ones who envy the goy? Right. So what she said to him basically is, you're going to live in the Stalinist era. Your life is going to hang by a thread. You're going to have to walk the red line of the communist insanity. And you're going to have the eyes of Zenosh envy on you. And that was Marina Svetayeva said that. We talk a lot about Marina Svetayeva. She's a saint in our house.
Where's her photograph gone?
It's in the poetic craft box, I think.
Oh.
We have to make a shrine for her. We really do have to make a shrine for her now. We make shrines to Russian poets. This is what we do. So, to cut to the chase, he grew up, he survived. He lived, I believe, into the early 90s. He did live. He is now a national hero.
The 1990s, or his 90s.
Yeah, 1990s.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, because he was born at the beginning. He was born just before the First World War, because Maktova and her husband were mostly active, you know, before the Bolshevik regime in 1917. He was born in October 1st, 1917, I think, something
right.
like that. So he was born right into the nightmare of the Stalinist.
So
Jewish
he was in the gulag pretty young then.
Yes, he was. In and out of the gulag. He studied. He studied languages. He was particularly interested in the racial story of the Tatars, which is opens up a whole new vein here. The Tatars is a great thread in the Sofianic narrative that's now opening up. And he developed a theory which had strong anti-Semitic elements in it. And he wrote about 8 books. And at the end of his life, he wrote the crowning achievement of his work, which is called, drum roll please, Ethnogenesis and the Biosphere.
I fell on the floor when you told me that the other day.
Ethnogenesis and the Biosphere. And what does he say in this book? He says basically that an ethnos, which is a race of people like the Japanese, the Greeks, the Finns, is a living unit of nature. It's a unit of nature just like anything else in nature. So the evolution and emergence of ethnic groups or racial groups is called ethnogenesis. And he studied this process of ethnogenesis, and I'm going to study it now, so I'm going to read that book once Nemeta is launched.
But this is really pertinent because you have been saying for a really long time now that the reason that the Zenosh have got as far as they have is because of their epigenesis.
That's right.
And the Goyim have no epigenesis.
That's
it's
right.
It's been lost.
That's right. It was lost when the mysteries were destroyed.
So you have been saying for a while, you see it as your one of your roles is to restore the epigenesis of the
Anthropos. Of the Rome.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, I can say now, today, that that's the completion of my work. That's the last thing I have to do. All of the pieces are complete. All of the pieces are now on the table. Put with this ethnogenesis of Lev Gumilov, it's like putting the last chunk of a big jigsaw puzzle together.
It's that blank bit of the sea.
That's right.
that last bit.
That's the hardest part to put in, right? And so basically, I'll have a lot to say about this in the future, which goes out exclusively to people on Nemeta, to members. It'll be in Turton and the Termine, it'll be in Breaking News. Basically, what he said is, get this, it doesn't get any better than this. He said that not only is every ethnos, which is his word for an ethnic or racial group, a natural and organic organism of the planet, but it is interactive with the biosphere of the planet, each one in its own way. And he studied this on the basis of case studies that he did, of ethnicities that he studied in what is called Eurasia. So he is known as the father of Eurasianism. And today, in Kazakhstan, at this futuristic city, which is the capital of Kazakhstan, which is called Astana, this futuristic city, there is a shrine to him because he gave the ethnogenetic identity to those people. And I'm going to turn around and give it to everybody in the Goyim. Because this racial epigenesis is what changes the game. So the solution to the second part of the riddle, identification of the rider, comes in the instruction of racial epigenesis. And that's what I do now. That's what I do in Nemeta, through Nemeta. And it's the end. It's all I have left to do. And I'm so relieved and I'm so thrilled and happy that I finally know. That I finally know that. It's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Truly.
So that's when you were explaining to me about him the other day, I said, oh, that's why it's the white races that care about nature. That's why it's the white races that care about animals.
His concept of ethnogenesis corresponds. It's like it was a convergence. It was like two comets colliding. Because I've been on this course for some time now that I've set myself on, because I said to myself, okay, there's a section of Nemeta called biomysticism. How am I going to open up this section?
What is biomysticism?
What is biomysticism, and what's going to be the first block? And I said, well, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to show in the first block of biomysticism that there is something called the anthropic morphic field. And that I'm going to describe what is a morphic field in terms of the different races of people. And I'm going to explain the difference between a morphic field of human animals and a morphic field of dogs, monarch butterflies,
starlings
in murmuration, caribou migrating, a morphic field of an elephant troop. A troop of elephants is a morphic field.
A shoal of fish.
Shoal of fish is a morphic field. So she creates, in the abundance of her so-called fertility, all of these glorious morphic fields. And among them all, not greater or less than any of the others, but different, is the human morphic field. And by the understanding of the dynamics of the anthropogenic or human-generated morphic field, we go to racial epigenesis and we go to solution. Race is the solution. Race is not the problem. The problem is those who would make race a problem.
You mean diversity is now strength?
Something tells me that phrase is due to backlash, very strongly.
All of those phrases, that, you know, this thing in Chemnitz.
Yeah.
You know, they call all of those people neo-Nazis.
Right.
It's like racist a few years ago. Racist, get called a racist, it doesn't mean anything. It just flies off the shoulder. Being called a neo-Nazi, whatever.
I mean, I ask you, what happens when certain people of the left, who are obviously, you know, known to be, that's farm equipment, it's very noisy. Which one?
This one here.
Oh. When certain people who are known to be the nefarious agents of cultural Marxism point to the people of Chemnitz who are simply protesting because one of their members was brutally murdered in public.
He was an integrated...
Yeah, was a Cuban. Was an integrated German, right?
An assimilated
German. Right. Mm. When they point to these people and they make out as if the protests of these people to the commission of a violent and hateful act is an act of evil worse than the murder itself. And they start calling them Nazis. Well, what's going to happen is they're going to turn into what you're calling them.
Better to be hung for a sheep than hung for a lamb.
Better to be hung for a sheep than a lamb. And this is what it's all about. And this is what's happening right now. And the tide is really turning. Because these are just ordinary, decent people. And they also carry the lie. Many of them probably believe in the lie about Hitler and the Nazis. And so now people are calling them Nazis. Simply because they're upset. Because
they're expressing an emotion.
That is
feeling awful that these people, these economic migrants,
murdered someone and that they're going to get away with it.
Stabbed three people, one of which died.
Yeah. And they're going to get away with it.
For cash at a cash machine.
Yeah. And their protest and their expression of their grief is considered to be an act of hatred. A neo-Nazi act of hatred. Whereas the act that was committed upon the person who was murdered is not an act of hatred or an act of violence that anyone would bother about.
Okay, so quickly, talk about our friend Julie in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
She got it. It's been nagging you, but you couldn't quite formulate it because we're literally wading in Nemeta and other stuff that's been going on at the moment. So Julie got it and she sent it to you last night and you went... Fucking A.
Right. Our German...
Actually, I think Dan sent it.
Right. Our German...
Yeah, it was Julie's. Julie got it.
Lakota Sioux ally in Arizona sent me the decoding of Chemnitz.
Our beloved Native American Nazi.
Yes. Sent me the decoding of Chemnitz. Because I was looking at this name. Chemnitz. And I was thinking... Well, wait a minute, you know, I said at the end of the MED that proof of correction would be encoded in people names and place names, didn't I?
So for anyone that doesn't know, this town, it's an industrial town in the old East Germany. So it was under communist rule. It has a statue of Karl Marx built by a Japanese sculptor for some reason.
Yeah.
In brass, I think, maybe.
No, in stone.
In stone. And he kept, John, you kept saying it's as big as this house.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen a picture of it until I looked at the link that Julian Dan, and it is as big as this house.
It's enormous. And the town used to be called Karl Marx Stadt. So right in the heart of where the poison of the Zenosh communist domination game was planted in Germany, Karl Marx Stadt, an event happens. This is the trigger event for historical correction. And it happens at this place called Chemnitz. So I'm looking and saying, what is this thing about Chemnitz, you know? And I didn't stop to try to decode it. Then, what, 2 days ago, we get this message.
It was yesterday.
Get this message. Now, I'm not going to decode it because I'm going to tell you who are we talking to. I don't know when this is going out or where, but it's something that I'm saving for Nematok. Mm. Because it's better to send it to people who are dedicated, show their dedication to wanting to know it rather than to just put it out
willy-nilly
to anyone, willy-nilly. Because that has reached, I've done that a lot, and it's reached the point where that is not productive in regard to the greater scheme of things.
Well, okay? this is a realization that I had just today. In fact, while you were telling me about the riddle, is that Nemeta has, not only it's given you relief of handover, but it's also inspired you to write more. You're writing a lot more than you've done for a really long time, and you're enjoying it, and you're able to do it for quite a few hours, whereas, you know, you've been complaining that you're not able to write like you used to. And, you know, the fact that the people who listen to you, who are dedicated, where you're going to put things like this talk, actually give a fuck.
Yeah, they do.
About your message, about everything that's going on, about Sophia, the whole story.
What I can say now, in bringing my whole life work to its completion... Now that I know it's complete, right, has to be said to people who are committed, and I can't just spread it out to the world at large. You know, it doesn't work that way anymore.
No.
So, in conclusion, something else you'd like to say?
No, we finished on Chemnitz for a minute, I mean.
Right, I'm not going to disclose that now, because it requires a little talk in itself.
But the photograph is worth talking
about. The photograph that came with the decoding of the correction clues in the name Chemnitz is a photograph of wolves. Need the battery.
So it's
statues of wolves.
So in front of the building where Karl Marx's ugly postulant head is.
Right.
Because we weren't sure what the...
And I don't think this is Photoshop, but I don't know who did this.
We weren't sure who wrote it until we read through it a few times, and then, oh, that's really liberal and really lefty.
This photograph, which will be coming out on Nemeta, says, on Thursday, which is the 13th of September 2018, we show, now this is a Google Translator, maybe that means we saw, I don't know if it means we displayed.
It's a German website,
yeah.
And the translation,
yeah.
I don't think was probably good.
We show 10 giant bronze wolves.
All doing the Roman salute.
Right, in front of the Karl Marx Monument in Chemnitz. 5 wolves show the Hitler salute. Some attack, others have blindfolds, and are still on a leash.
Wow.
And the title of this article is, in German, The Wolves Are Back. Well, who are the wolves? Well, of course, the wolf was the first totemic animal of the Nazi party of the Third Reich.
Zos evil Germans.
Sigma. So, on a concluding note, We'll conclude with the same way that we concluded the previous conversation we had when I said, I'm only doing one thing here. Out of everything I've done, everything I've considered, everything I've contributed, every word that I've written, every word of poetry, everything that I've taught about mythology, directed mythology, everything that I've revived in Gnosis, all contributes to one act that I have achieved, that I have set a standard. That's the whole purpose of my life. And what is the standard? It is the standard by which you prove the true power of imagination and how it works.
The true power of her imagination and your own imagination.
That's right. The true power of the synergy of divine and human imagination and how it works. I set the standard for that.
Because you proved it.
Because I proved it, I've demonstrated it, I've lived it. And everyone who recognizes that standard for what it is and makes the commitment to live up to it themselves can now know that this correction shall not fail.